Hi, I'm Doug Gordon, and this is Beta. Everyone thinks they're a comedian these days. They're always making jokes and cracking sarcastic comments. At least, that's what Ken Jennings thinks. He's the author of Planet Funny: How Comedy Took Over Our Culture. You might remember Ken from Jeopardy. He's the 74-time champion. Ken says that these days, everybody wants to be funny. But why?
I think just because it's so hard to back out of. You know, once somebody has decided to be funny, anybody else who comes back kind of earnest and heartfelt, or even worse, solemn and humorless, just seems stodgy and out of touch by comparison. So humor is a ratchet in a culture that only works one way. Things can get more funny all the time, and then they seem fun and edgy and youthful and transgressive, but you can never wind it back. So what we're seeing now is that ratchet increasing in almost every area of public life.
Yeah, so it has to keep evolving and amping up, and there's no turning back. We're not going to get less funny. We have to become more funny. You say that our gradual descent into this nonstop comedy culture started in the early decades of the 20th century, and you blame it all on one man. Who?
There's a Russian futurist poet. The futurists were in love with the modernity of the new century, and there was going to be new technology and trains and radio. And there was a Russian named Velimir Klebnikov who was in love with all this, and he considered himself a bit of a seer. He actually predicted the internet. He predicted the Leninist revolution in Russia. And he wrote a poem called Invocation of Laughter, which is kind of a celebration of laughter above all. And to me, it predicts the next century of human civilization very well.
Could you read this poem for us?
Yeah, it's short. O laugh, laughers, O laugh out, laughers, you who laugh with laughs, you who laugh it up laughishly, O laugh out laugheringly, O be laughable laughterhood, the laughter of laughering laughers, O unlaugh it out laughingly, be laughering laughists, laughily lappily, up laugh, end laugh, laughlings, laughlings, laughlets, laughlets, O laugh, laughers, O laugh out, laughers.
So how exactly does this Russian poem from 109 years ago predict our current comedy culture?
Well, I like how it's just a series of kind of invented words and riffs on the word laugh. You know, in Russian as in English, laughlings and laughterhood and be laughable, these are not words.
Right.
But it really reminds me of how our idea of what a joke is and how it can be structured has just mutated endlessly like a fractal or a snowflake in the 20th and now in the 21st century. Because as you say, it's got to evolve. It's got to be something new that maybe our ancestors or even our parents wouldn't even have recognized as a joke.
Sure. So talk a bit about this mutation. Play this out for me. How have jokes mutated? How have they changed over the last century or last 100 years or so?
I don't think it's just tastes shifting or things going back and forth, you know, like airline jokes coming into vogue and then out. It's not just fads like that. I really do feel like there's an evolution where jokes have gotten more complex, more sophisticated, and weirdly kind of more vague and harder to point to. I think for centuries, jokes were explicable, basically. You know, you could explain a joke or a one-liner with a simple one-line explanation if the person doesn't get the joke. You could say, oh, he was referring to a drink called a grasshopper, not the grasshopper who walked into the bar.
Yeah.
And nobody would laugh at people would be like, oh, okay, right. And today, the comic sensibility is really a lot more elusive. It's really just saying something so off the wall that people kind of give a sharp barking laugh of absurdity like, whoa, the punchline of that joke is to mention cranberry bogs. I've never really thought of cranberry bogs as a funny thing, but well, there it is on Family Guy. I guess it's a joke now.
Yeah, exactly. And you talk about Neil Postman's 1985 book, Amusing Ourselves to Death. And in this book, Postman expressed concern that mass media was going to be the death knell for American culture. Do you see a connection between Postman's prediction and our contemporary comedy-centric culture?
I do. You know, he was talking about news getting lighter and goofier and celebrity culture taking over, you know, things that were light and frivolous bleeding into things that he thought should be serious. He doesn't really call out comedy per se, but what I've noticed about our era is all the stuff he was worried about, all the technological frivolousness that's going to distract us from affairs of real import. Increasingly, we've chosen to anesthetize ourselves with comedy. That's what makes us feel good. Often the endless stream of content on our phone is jokes. You know, a lot of the backlog of stuff I feel like I have to see on Netflix are stand-up specials. There's just more of this than we can ever possibly watch. You know, we spend our lives looking at a stream of jokes and slightly amusing cat videos on our phones.
Yeah, exactly. So talking about the internet, how much of a part has the internet, and in particular particular Twitter, played in comedy's conquest of our culture.
Twitter was why I particularly wrote the book. I'm sure other people have their own comedy Achilles heels or kryptonite or whatever you call the thing that ruins your life. But for me, it was definitely Twitter. You know, at first it was such a joy that all these funny people, not just famous comedians and comedy writers, but just kind of random civilians from all over the world, were riffing and joking together on the affairs of the day. And as soon as something goofy happened, a raccoon would climb a building in Toronto and you'd immediately see 500 jokes about it. You wouldn't have to wait for Jimmy Fallon or the Weekend Update people to write jokes. What a blessing to have all that in my pocket.
So follow up on that comment you made about Twitter ruining your life. How has it ruined your life? That because you're trying to make jokes all the time on Twitter? Tell me about that.
That's part of it. I mean, part of it is it turns us all into comedians. We're no longer an audience out there with our drinks, you know, laughing in the darkness. We're all like, ooh, I got to get in here. What can I say? You know, so you have that little white rectangle in Twitter that wants you to just make a joke, be funny like these people. And that's not good for your brain to always be the guy who's trying to think of a joke. It's also not good for your relationships, I think. It's not good spiritually. But also just the fact that I had this machine in my pocket that could just give me this endless stream of amusement anytime I looked on it. I found it very addictive. The brain doesn't have a satiety signal for internet content the way it does for food or sex or even heroin, you know, like that's something you can get addicted to and your brain will just never get enough. It wants you to just keep checking your phone for new jokes until you die.
You probably don't experience this much because you're quite funny, but there's the frustration if you have a joke that you post on Twitter that you think is great and then you hear crickets.
That happens to me all the time. And sometimes, you know, that's not the worst case scenario. The worst case scenario is saying you thought was sort of snarky and offhand and then realizing that what you had written down was far more, you know, offensive or wrong or transgressive in some way than you ever meant. And then you just look like an idiot. There's a world full of bajillions of jokes and you added the wrong one completely unnecessarily. That can ruin your day.
Can you give me an example of a joke you made that ruined your day because you didn't see the implications?
On Twitter, it can be anything. You know, I remember making a joke once about, I think, beehives and colony collapse disorder, and I had a beekeeper tell me very sternly that that was not helping the cause. You know, the thing about the internet is there's a subculture for everything. So if you make a slightly irreverent joke about Star Wars fans, you will immediately hear from 100 angry Star Wars fans who amplify it to thousands of others, and then it turns into a thing.
Sure. Okay, well, let's flip it around. What is the best Twitter joke that you've made, the one you're most proud of? Can you point to one?
I wish there was a single thing I've said on Twitter that I didn't feel kind of vaguely ashamed of afterwards. Like, that's kind of the effect of social media.
But there must be one that you're less ashamed of.
At first, when it was 140 characters, you could really do a nice, tight one-liner. And, you know, you would feel good if you really nailed something. Like I remember saying one time, how do they get the hurricanes to arrive in alphabetical order? To me, it's a mildly funny observation that switches up cause and effect. But, you know, I felt like a king. I told a funny joke on Twitter.
There was this recent incident involving this social media comedian, Darren Knight, at the Just for Laughs Comedy Festival in Montreal. And he was booed off stage after insulting his fellow comedians, the audience, and the festival. It's proof, isn't it, that just because you're funny online, it doesn't mean you're going to be funny on stage.
That's exactly right. And it means you have to tailor your audience to the room. You know, his hilarious Southern Mama material did not play in a room of hardened comedians and comedy fans in Montreal.
Surprise.
We're all kind of increasingly comedy geeks. I think he didn't account for the fact that the mainstream comedy audience is now an obsessed and geekish one who is very aware of what all the current fault lines and discussions are and the current level of policing of different topics. I'm not against this new woker audience, honestly. I think it's great that instead of giving comedians a pass and being like, well, he said something awful, but he's a comedian. It's just Roseanne being Roseanne. I like the idea that we're actually able to grapple with these things now and say, well, hold on, like, what are the effects of that joke? Why wouldn't you flip the joke around so it actually took on someone in a powerful position instead of a weaker one, or, you know, any of these endless discussions that we have about jokes today. I think that's great that we're thinking more seriously, because if humor is going to be a dominant force in our culture, we can't just give everybody a hall pass to make whatever awful jokes they want.
Yeah, I agree with you. There's been a lot of research into humor and what makes us laugh over the last several years. Is there anyone who you think has come close to creating a grand unified theory of jokes?
One thing I really wanted in my book was, what's the grand unified theory? Because nobody's sure. You know, Aristotle and Socrates thought jokes were for ridicule, and Freud thought it was to blow off steam about taboo sexual topics, predictably, because he's Freud. And Kant thought it was all incongruity. You know, some expectation gets deflated, and then you laugh. You know, the thing that satisfies me most as a unified theory is just the idea that there's an evolutionary reason maybe for comedy, that our primate ancestors needed to find it pleasurable when they found some little absurdity or incongruity in life, and then they solved the problem. Mm. They thought, oh, I see why I tried to stab the fish, but I missed, or I tripped over the vine in the path, you know?
Yeah.
The cavemen who didn't find that pleasurable to make those little discoveries immediately died out, all by tripping over vines.
Yeah.
But the ones who could laugh at it lived to fish another day. So comedy may have been how we became human.
Sure, part of the survival of the fittest, a good sense of humor. You talk about a joke that a young Woody Allen told in a Washington, D.C. nightclub in 1965. Can you tell me a bit about the joke and what you find so amazing about it?
Well, I mean, I guess it's problematic to use Woody Allen as your example.
Yeah, I wondered about that, but I figured, what the heck, because it was a very good point you made, I thought.
You know, as I was writing the book, I kept having to modify different parts of the book as different comedians fell into disrepute, you know, like, oh, let's search and replace for Cosby. The Woody Allen story, it's on one of his very first records, and he's talking to a club audience, and he says,
I must pause for one fast second and say a fast word about oral contraception. I was involved in an extremely good example of oral contraception 2 weeks ago. I asked a girl to go to bed with me, and she said no.
And there's this long pause in the room while people wait to hear why she said no. And suddenly people realize, oh, oral contraception. Oh, I get it. That's the. And so, like, seconds later, there's this huge laugh. And the funny part of that story to me is how we've evolved as an audience. Today, it would not take a savvy comedy club audience a long 5 second silence to get that joke. We would probably have heard similar jokes, you know, like, people calling thick glasses birth control glasses, for example. It's a comedy trope we're all familiar with. And we all know how jokes are constructed now, and Woody would not have surprised us today. It's evidence that comedy doesn't just change. It really does evolve like a species.
As you point out, protest signs, historically, they haven't been a real hotbed of comedy. But that has been changing recently, hasn't it?
That's one of the most interesting things I found, and it's related to this idea that comedy is becoming woke and political, and we want to make sure that it does good in the world and not just diverts people. And yeah, you go to any kind of demonstration or protest march today, no matter what the issue is, and you'll find people really like workshopping jokes on their signs. You know, anti-Trump posters will say, "We shall overcome," you know, whereas 50 years ago, the civil rights marchers would have said, "We shall overcome." You know, people, part of it is wanting to go viral, but I think part of it is really, this is how you communicate in our culture now. You convince people by making them laugh.
Exactly. As you write in the book, social protest is borrowing the language of comedy because comedy is quickly absorbing the concerns of social protest.
Watching Hannah Gadsby do Nanette and say things that are not funny at all about sexual abuse and homophobia and rape and assault, people have realized they can use this comedy monologue form to make people laugh, but at the same time, to be activists, to be convincing about an agenda that maybe people need some convincing on. Because when it's in a comedy routine, you let down your guard.
Mm-hmm. What do we gain and what do we lose when our culture is all comedy all the time?
Well, I mean, we've seen some of the dangers. You know, politics used to be a no-comedy zone. Abraham Lincoln was a funny guy, but he refused to tell jokes in debates or on the stump because he thought these were serious times, the people deserved a serious president. And that all went out the window in 1992 when Bill Clinton ran for president, and he was going to be the guy playing the sax with Arsenio and hanging out with Larry King and Phil Donahue, and everyone at the time tut-tutted about how this was the end of civilization. But young people loved it. Look, he's accessible, he's approachable, he's our generation, he's joking around. And it's landed us where we are today, you know, in a world where a generation gets their news from comedy shows. And it's very easy for a certain kind of showman to win political office ahead of more qualified people because we expect the day's events to be entertaining above all.
Yeah.
So I think there are dangers and downsides. And the problem is, I don't know what to do. I love comedy. You know, the book is a love letter, I think, to comedy. I've loved it my whole life.
What is good about this all-comedy culture in which we live?
You know, I like that it's leveled the playing field. You know, the technology aspect has really let funny people that you wouldn't expect have a platform. You know, now it's no longer just the same 30 white men who were on the Lampoon together at Harvard. Our new technology really does allow people to have a voice. And satire has a certain power. A satirist can use exaggeration and hyperbole. It can like lull a suspicious audience into listening to a topic, a tricky topic about race or feminism or class or whatever it is that they might be a little bit ginger about. So comedy's great that way. And it feels so good. It's a hard world, you know? We need a laugh at the end of the day.
Ken Jennings is the author of Planet Funny, how comedy took over our culture. I'll take show endings for 600, Alex.
The other daily level.
Binge on past episodes by subscribing to the Beta Podcast via iTunes or wherever you catch your favorite pods. You can keep up with us during the week online at WPR.org/beta or on Twitter at WPRBeta. Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions. Our technical director and music director is Steve Gotcher.
Steve.
What is the Sphinx?
Yes.
Could I have singers in the films?
Whoop. Hang on.
What is the Sphinx?
I thought that's what he said.
Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich.
Great performance by Adam, the giant killer.
And thanks to you, our Alphas.
If you guys ring in and get this one, I will die.
Until next week, I'm Doug Gordon.
Doug, I have to say, it has been a pleasure.